John Summers is the motoring historian. He was a company car thrashing technology sales rep that turned into a fairly inept sports bike rider. Hailing from California, he collects cars and bikes built with plenty of cheap and fast, and not much reliable. On his show, he gets together with various co-hosts to talk about new and old cars, driving, motorbikes, motor racing, and motoring travel.
Good day, good morning, good afternoon, and welcome to The Motoring Historian with John Summers and Mark Agami. Mark Agami, I mean, I don't know if this is actually episode 17, because now Eric does all the editing for me, so it might be episode 17, but it's around that, like, this is impressive. Or maybe it's not, well, I don't know.
We've got enough bullshit to fill 17 hours worth of stuff. I think that was kind of...
Oh, I think more than 17 hours. More than 17, I've been editing it out. Believe it or not,
all of our bon mo on the cutting room floor. What can you say?
Yeah, so get this right. Get this. I'm watching Furious Driving, that YouTuber, right? Do you know him? He's probably too annoying for you. He's in Kent. He has what you would describe as shit cars. Let's just cut straight to the chase. So that's probably why you don't watch him. And his style is a little irritating, but I do like him. I don't know what quite how I think it's because I'm just attracted to these YouTubers who have large amounts of terrible vehicles that they nobly try and keep going, or maybe idiotically try and keep going. But you know, that's the, but look, he has this Unos MX-5, whatever. He has this relationship with this company called Auxito, who do lights, HED lights. And it put me in mind of something that you may or may not remember. Remember in the days when it was cool to do business travel, and for a couple of years in a row, you used to do conferences in Las Vegas with whatever tech company. Was it Brocade? Was it that who you were working for there?
Oh, I've been there with multiple companies. Yeah. Avaya. Yeah. Mortel.
So one of those Christmases, one of those like New Year's, you were there for a conference and I drove down and stayed with you. I drove down in the Mustang and we hung out and did whatever. And I hung out in the room. I remember I was writing at the time. So I did like whatever writing I was doing in your hotel room in the day. And then like we had time together in the evening. And when I drive home, I left late at night and I went straight across. Instead of like doing 15 to LA and coming off like and going across like 50, I think it is, to Bakersfield and then on to I-5 and up that way, I just went the sort of more direct way, which was right across Death Valley. I went through, but I went out of...
I've driven it, yeah. It's a good way.
Well, at night...
That's the place where it's got that famous sign saying, oh, I don't know if it's famous, but it's impressive. Like, no gas next 200 miles.
Yeah, it is that spot, yeah. 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 Anyway, on that piece of road, having left your place at like, left Vegas like at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, something like that. I maybe never even told you this. I don't think I did. That's why I wanted to save it for the pod. I was running not that fast, but fast enough, you know, a number that I don't really want to mention on the pod. And certainly it was fast enough that we came over a rise, and over the rise, the road changed direction and I was in the desert. I was off the road in the desert, right? Literally a cactus up against the nose of the car. Like it wasn't like I crashed against the cactus, but I do remember the cactus being like right there, like, and the note and the corner of the bumper resting on it. Well, luckily it was what had happened. So anyway, long and short was, so I was off the road so I could find reverse, and you know, there was a bit of wheel spin and I needed to move some stuff around so it could drag itself back onto the road. But fortunately it wasn't too rough off the road and it hadn't gone too far off the road, and it's, you know, a Mustang, not something more delicate. So, you know, I dare say the tracking wasn't what it once was, but you know, the thing still, the motor had never shut off. you know, I, because I found reverse and got straight back out onto the road, like without messing around. I didn't get out of the car until I, anyway, long and short, having got going again, I realized that what had happened was I had been running too fast for the throw of the headlights. So in that moment, I was like, I want proper lights. Always wanted HID brighter lights, surely be able to get some, just the bulbs, right? I don't want spotlights to make the car look like a rally car at the front of it. I just wanted better bulbs to go in the same. This is what Auxito do. So, and this is the interesting shtick, right? I mentioned it on a previous pod. And what I mentioned was that Furious Driving had fitted it. I had bought some on the back of that. On the back of me buying them, they mailed me and said, did I want a discount code? I said, yes. My discount code is Motoring Historian. It gives you 15%. I get a kickback of that 15%. So imagine how surprised I was when I received an email saying that I'd got a $50 kickback from an order that had been placed just the other day. I realized, Mark, that that token payment, which my wife sneered at, my son sneered at the its paltry nature. I put it to you, not paltry at all. I put it to you that there is value. I've been paid for this bullshit. That's awesome. That is an awesome thing. That is a milestone. And I really want to recognize Auxito in that. Now, all of this, right? I haven't fitted the bulbs to the Mustang yet.
That's my next question. Are they any fucking good? We're wasting all this time jerking off about Auxito. If the fucking bulbs are shit. I don't want to know.
Well, look, right, we are nothing if not honest, right? So I was going to just fit them to the Mustang, right? And it seems like it being a Mustang, you have to like get the battery out of the wire on one side before you can get your hand on the piece of aged, desiccated.
You've got to get into a Ford headlamp. I'm not having it.
Yeah, cut the back of your hand just investigating it. Yeah. Yes, of course, right. Yes. Look, right, I'm gonna do it properly. I'm gonna find a piece of road and I'm actually gonna do a test. I don't give a shit about lumens. I'm gonna answer your question absolutely applied to a similar case study. Now, I'm not gonna try and crash the Mustang off the road again, driving too fast on a dark road. No. I'm going to position the car on a dark road in front of a sign at a certain measurable distance and take a picture. And then I'm going to do the same thing when I've got the Auxito bulbs in. So there will be a measurable before and after, and I will then know whether or not to endorse these Auxito bulbs, which pay me a commission if you use the code Motoring Historian when you're buying these HED uplift bulbs. They do look brighter on Furious Drivings, by the way.
You corporate whore.
Yeah, absolutely, right, absolutely. And, you know, I don't know what we're going to do, because the music in this episode is going to be called Company Cars Running Wild, right? And you said we need to do an episode featuring Running Wild, and we absolutely do need to do an episode featuring Running Wild, and this is going to be it. And now I don't know what we're going to do, because we've got to, you know, because that might mean that we're demonetized, but we've got advertising, and we certainly didn't ought to be airing this
dirty. People ought to buy the Running Wild albums on the back of this. That's what we're doing. We're promoting Running Wild. We're saying, like, you make, because they're still out there making their like pirate themed cheese. Yeah, go and buy that cheese.
They, him, Rolf.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm sure he has other people like swanning around time to time on Turnstile.
No, the most recent album he just did himself.
Well, all of it.
In his personal studio. Damn. Yeah. Yeah, think about that.
You can support Rolf.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is the spirit of heavy metal is still strong, right?
And Lou, that's why I was mentioning people to you, like, who are those mofos that did that classic album that was absolutely amazing, and then they never did another. Well, I mean, that's a bunch of heavy metal bands. It'll come back to me. They did like Silver Bullet Toy and stuff like that. Oh, so I'll look it up on iTunes whilst we're chatting. I like the idea of supporting albums, but like people like RPLA and stuff, who did one album that was amazing and then never got anything ever again, because people can still buy that album, probably, if you look for it hard enough. So therefore, go out and get it, because hopefully that geezer's still getting royalties off those. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So RPLA, yeah, because RPLA were the introduction of the Ferrari pod that launched, with was a monologue one that I did. So I took your advice to do RPLA and used the intro to City of Angels as the intro to the pod. Maybe a little discordant for Ferrari, in fact, I thought afterwards. But, you know, our brand is slightly discordant. Okay, yeah, so going to test back to Auxito. Going to test the Auxito. The other product that I was going to mention is this Outroll product, right, which this guy Chops Garage, who I follow, uses. This is not sponsored by me or anything, but this stuff is remarkable. You put it on a cloth, you rub it on a foggy headlight, the foggy headlight gets clearer. No messing around with sanding or anything like that. You know the way headlights on cars like our Fiesta goes all yellow and you can't see properly, and that really blunts the headlight's performance. If you put this Outroll stuff on it, it clears off that top layer. Right. I guess it's good for bringing back plastic, black plastic that's faded. That's why Chops uses it to make his cheapy used cars look better. Chops Garage on YouTube. I like the bloke. He's in North Devon. But look, right, I don't need to. But what I'm saying is, I'm going to do the Outroll on the headlights before. So it's going to be an even test. They're going to be freshly Outrolled before I do the bulb test. So watch this space, Montgomery, and we will be able to answer the question, how good are these Auxito bulbs?
Zan Clan.
Go. Oh, yeah, exactly. Go.
Absolutely rocking song. But there's a few tracks on the album that are worth listening to.
Yeah. It's one Swedish dude or Scandi. It's one dude from that part of the world, from Scandinavia, Norway, Finlandy kind of a dude. Yeah. Dude, this week, I went to the launch of the Nissan 400 Nismo. It was at this place called Z Car Garage in San Jose. It is a street version of their Group 4 race car. And I didn't even know what a Group 4 race car was until Ollie was telling me about it on Gran Turismo. And that's the standard. So the Group 4 race car is $250,000. The Nismo that was there at Z Car Garage that I sat in, dude, it was like yours, right? In the it felt like the Z cars don't feel like anything. So they don't feel like Corvettes. They definitely don't feel like Camaros or anything like that. A Z car feels like a Z car. So it felt like your 350 when I first sat in it. But the first thing you would have said was it's bigger and fatter than my 350. And nice materials inside, suede-y. This one, an automatic. The cheaper ones, and like the sort of middle one with the track pack. So there's like the Nismo, the track pack one, and then the bassy one. The old bassy one and the middle one, you can get with a stick and three pedals. I obviously checked on that. They also had some kind of IMSA beast. Not an R390, but some kind of IMSA beast that was in the showroom. And I didn't notice until I heard a mechanic talking to some, I don't know if she was a journalist or some other, a guest that was there looking. And she had noticed that one of the air intakes didn't match the other air intake. And the mechanic was saying, oh, yeah, because the turbo's only on one side. And they've worked really hard to, like, regulate the airflow, because on one side it all goes into the turbo, and on the other side it all, like, sculpts over the body to create the sort of, you know, Group C whole car is a wing kind of thing. And I was reminded of that when we were talking just before we came on air, so to speak, about Goodwood featuring Can-Am, because those cars have that same kind of, the body is just one giant wing. And I think that that's interesting from a, you know, engineering point of view, but it's also interesting from the small boy kind of perspective, which is that this is a large surface to have big colors and graphics and branding and the things that as small boys you remember. And I think that's why my son loves the Group C cars so much. Like, they have that, there's a visual presence about them. What we at Pebble Beach, you know, what the Pebble Beach judges call elegance, right? That, you know, there's that, what wins Pebble Beach is elegance. The Group C car doesn't have elegance, but it has the same kind of, like, Shazam kind of presence, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, that's a fair comment.
All right. So Google this up, right? Gerald Lang. So Andy Warhol, the pop artist, right?
Yeah.
Roy Lichtenstein, the pop artist. Lichtenstein did the dot style. Lichtenstein develops the dot style with this dude, Gerald Lang, right? Lang is a Englishman born in Newcastle, Sandhurst, father and major in the army, drops out, goes to art school, mates with David Hockney, goes to New York, mates with Andy Warhol, develops the dot style with Lichtenstein. While all the others circle the plug hole, he buys a weird fortified house way up in the north bit of Scotland, like north of Elgin, like that far, like way up there, right? And he's just up there doing his family and generally not doing like the LSD crap that all the others did in the 70s. The muse in the 70s is this dragster guy, Don Garlitz, with his Swamp Rat dragsters. Also Jimmy Clark. So it's Jimmy Clark pop art. I was asked to help maybe even try and, let's just call a spade because it's our pod, sell these paintings, right? There's a bunch of them. He did a lot of them. And I looked closely at his work and at the other work that he did, because he also did pop icons. So he also did like Kate Moss, and he also did Victoria Beckham. Sorry?
There's a couple of Brigitte Bardot, isn't there?
Yeah, but well, Amy Winehouse. I think it's Amy Winehouse, isn't it?
No.
Anyway, the point is that he did, you know, terrible women and racing drivers, and the Garlitz painting is a life size. It's basically 1-to-1 scale. It's like 22 feet long and 7 feet high. Swamp Rat 7, it's called, right? So I was asked to write pieces that might help publicize this art and get it sold. And I ended up feeling, I said to the guy that had asked me to do the work, dude, if I had a house in Miami, I would want that Swamp Rat 7, the 22 by life size dragster. I would want that in, that would be like in the living room. That really is an awesome piece of modern art, you know.
Bigger is better with art. That's not talk about.
Yeah. So you're talking about both of them. You could buy a reasonably sized house for in either this community or in your community. But, you know, so what a cool project to be involved in, what a cool thing to write about, and what a cool thing to, you know, just So that was another little project that I very much enjoy. But look, right, company cars was the theme of the episode today. Yeah, 20 minutes in before we've hit the topic that we were really meant to talk about. That feels very...
pretty apposite.
Feels very par for the course. Company cars. So I thought I should probably explain... So firstly, right, why am I doing the company car episode? Well, because Eric put this voiceover in front of every episode that is the fluff that I wrote for the Acast thing, where I described you and I as company car thrashing sales reps, right? Which is kind of a crossover that we have. But now we're cast and framed. We're typecast as that, Mark. We're typecast as... So I thought at least we should try and explain what the whole company car thing is, right? And it is this, that in England and the rest of Britain in the 1960s, but especially into the 1970s, a culture evolved where job functions that required a good deal of driving, or corporations that wanted to be able to pay people with benefits in kind rather than just cash bonuses. Maybe the tax rate was very high, so it would maybe make more sense to give somebody something that wasn't taxable, a non-taxable asset. And that was really the deal with company cars in Britain, that originally the idea was that if you were a business person, you were using that car for work, so you would get that at a reduced tax rate. However, what it evolved into was it meant that everybody, even the managing director who just sat in the office all day, his Jaguar was owned by the company, because that was a $50,000 or $40,000 payment that could be made to him tax-free or at a significantly reduced tax rate. Now, this gives rise to some really interesting wrinkles in the way that vehicles were designed. A curiosity, Gammy. Sunroofs, right? Beloved by you and I, but then you and I are old-fashioned sales reps, aren't we? It's also England, right? And let's call it a spade a spade. The reason it was ace was because in England, it can often be sunny, but maybe be a bit rainy or something like that. You don't want the window down, but if the sunroof's open, it gives you some fresh air without it being too damp. Especially nice to smoke in, which again is super of the period, but that was the other reason why the sunroof is a total winner. Californians hate them. Guy across the road said to me, why would I want anybody to cut a hole in the roof of my car?
Yeah, he's not thinking.
Well,
properly. I mean, I understand, like, you know, that's being just ridiculously parochial. I mean, like, that cars are sold in other markets, you know, and like for a lot of markets, having like the ability to open up the roof, it's like, I mean, it's a bit like saying, why would I ever want a convertible? I mean, it's not quite as much, but it is the poor man's version.
It is. Well, that's exactly what it is. And in California, you would either have the full convertible, or, you know, that's the other thing is that, and this is maybe this is just a function of California, but that old E55 I have, the sunroof channels got all blocked up, right? The drain channels did, and then it rusted. So that's why it has the rust around the sunroof, because the channels got blocked up, and that's where it rusted. And that's another reason why people don't like.
Yeah. I mean, look, cars rust. I mean, it's, especially if you live next to the sea. I mean, it's going to
end. It is, you know,
basically, fuck off. Sunroofs are cool.
Well,
it's my give and take.
Exactly, right. And I'm pleased that I was looking for a way to segue back to company cars there, and you just gave it to me perfectly, right, is that the Sierra 2-liter with the sunroof is worth a shitload more than the 1600 without, right? That's
Oh, you want all the toys. Yeah, I mean, especially as a rep, all the toys, please. I want electric windows all round, obviously. I want, like, you know,
and this is because your base Sierra had crank windows. So this
exactly, and you wanted, you know, you wanted the 2 liter with the twin, with the nicer exhaust. Yeah, you wanted all that.
Well, you do, because when you're hot in traffic, when it's a sunny day and you're hot in traffic, if the car's got crank windows, you can't put all the windows down. You're sitting there like a tuna fish in the tinker. It's either blowy, make yourself look terrible before the meeting, or maybe crank the windows before, but who prepared? Electric windows, all four electric windows, you can set them perfectly. So there is real value in those little trinkets. But that graduation, which I grew up understanding and intrinsically valuing, that was a function of the company car era of Britain. And I think, so what we should say is that tax era went away, right? And if you think of it, we witnessed it, and I would say I witnessed it towards the end of my time in England, and I left England in 2003, because what companies stopped doing was giving you a car, and what they started doing was giving you a car allowance. So where it used to be that the fleet manager would buy like 20 Ford Cortinas, and, you know, they would be given to sales reps, or if you think of, you know, my first company car was that white Ford Mondeo, which my boss had had first, but the company had leased a new car for him. So he had the new, you know, and then, you know, it was like being the littlest, you know, I had a promotion to get that company car, even though my job was still based in the office. It wasn't a face-to-face thing. It was,
I mean, you're absolutely right. But I think also it's about dick measuring, because if you've got the gear and the other person's got the, like, the steelies with the plastic covers, like, you know, it's a cheapie, you know, and people live to be like one up in the neighbors.
It's so funny you say that, because one of the things on my little agenda is, do you remember the Ford Granada 2.8i Gear X? Do you remember the badging used to be so long, it almost went right the way to the trunk lid? It was like the lock in the middle of the trunk lid was the full stop on this absolute chintzed out Granada. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, but dude, people love that shit. I mean, and look, I mean, Porsche is making a career, an epoch defining company out of that. You know, there's a reason why they sell the fucking Turbo S first, because if you're the first person who's got to have that Porsche when it's released, you've got the money to spend on the Turbo S, even if you don't need the standard Cayenne, would have done you fine, thanks. But you have to pay 150 grand for the Turbo S because you want to show off at the car park Grand Prix.
You had those two Cupras. And then didn't you buy, so this is the area that I wanted to discuss with you, that there would be a company car policy, wouldn't there? And then, so in the days of, there was, so at first, like maybe when we were first working in the late 90s, that was when the company would like give you a car. And that was the notion of the pool car. And this is why we should pay honorable mention to that red Renault Laguna that you must have put, like,
269 CNE. About 60 to 80 clicks on it, I think.
In how long?
That was a company car that someone else had first, and I got. And then later on, when I worked at Redstone, it was similar with that silver, sort of first of the sort of whatever it was called, edge design.
The Focus. Talk about that, because you had that lovely silver. That was a Focus 2 liter gear, wasn't it? The top of the range.
That was the financial director's car before she left. And when I realized it was the 2 liter gear, they were like, well, you could have this instead if you want. I was like, yep,
yeah,
give me that. Amazing chassis.
Yeah.
Fabulous chassis. Underpowered, but you could keep up with, well, to quote a random, my mate's 225 horsepower TT through the back lanes, if you were taking racing lines and, you know, using the fact that the chassis was really good, you could keep up with him, much to his chagrin. But hey ho.
Thank you, Harry Jones, for taking the time to put that chassis under that Focus, because you put You put like 90,000 miles on that car and absolutely
killed it. Oh, at least, yeah. That one I had to from, I think from that one, they paid something like 18,000 like additional miles. It should have gone back way earlier. I think it should have gone back at 90 and I gave it back at 108. And it was just one of those ones where I said to them, like, it's done 90. And they were like, yeah, we'll get it back. We'll get it back. We'll get it back. And then like 4 months later, I'd done another 18,000 miles. It was just like the patch I had included Cornwall and some companies up in Manchester when I was living, you know, just south of
Reading. So we should talk about that, shouldn't we? That in those days, the way that you would sell was that you would talk on the phone to build some rapport and kind of establish a need. And then in order to flesh out that need, you would go and meet the person face to face. And that was a measure of commitment on both parties that, you know, you were wasting the time out of the office.
Yeah.
If you know, I remember that you even had a reseller partner when we were in the south of England. You had a reseller partner up in Warrington that you would drive up and see. So it was like a 4-hour drive up there to see people. And quite often those meetings went nowhere, right? Quite often you just did your presentation and...
Well, that was largely relationships with the guys at AFNET. Lovely bunch, absolutely cracking distributor. They got bought by well, they ended up over them. I can't remember who it is now, but yeah, I mean, really good bunch of guys. You're absolutely right. That was a day up there, so it'd be like 4.5 hours up there, about 4 or 5 hours up there. Take the couple of the reps out for lunch and stuff, and then drive back in the afternoon. So I would do the M6 north and then the M6 south in a day. Pretty quickly you rack up chonky miles on the wheels that you were living in. So many an audiobook's a great way to travel, except if you get sleepy, because then it's like your dad reading you a story when you were a kid. Then you get the music on because you need something, hanging the windows down and a coffee in you because you need to wake up. You carry on with the audiobook, you'll fall asleep, which is a stupid idea. So it's a good way to eat miles.
Yeah.
Not
and we should say as well for our listeners, if there are any, or stick shift, right? All of these cars are stick shift. And in this era, making probably more than 100 horsepower, but definitely less than 200.
Yeah, that, well, the quoted on that Ford Sierra, sorry, the Focus Gear was 130. I think the Laguna was probably making about 118, something like that, if I recollect.
Yeah, you're
but I mean, plenty enough to hustle your ass along.
Well,
if you were busy.
Is that thing, isn't with the, it with the stick. The it's a lot more fun to drive a slow car fast than a fast car slow. And these cars didn't have a lot of horse, but they were very light and, flimsy in comparison to modern cars, without the ABS, without the, and the weight of the ABS pumps and all of that, without airbags, all of that. So the dash area is just plastic, right? It's just plastic of the same grade as you.
My boss described the stereo in the Focus Gear as a bit Fisher Price. Yeah. Quote unquote, and he was right. They did have some big,
It did.
Buttons.
Well, it had that big swage across the dash, didn't it? Which, and front drivers mostly, right? Apart from your BMW and your BMW,
drivers, yeah, absolutely. But no, to your point about the having the company car policy. So the first time I got to choose a car, I brown nosed to the FD. Who I got on with particularly well, lovely lady. And she was, I thought it was going really well in the conversation. Then I realized when she went, Mark, what are you asking me? After about 3 minutes, that she just wasn't listening. And so I broke it down to the nuts and bolts. It was like, look, I've called the company car people, and for the same money as you were prepared to pay for the most expensive car on your 5-car list that I could choose from, which was a Golf 1.9 TDI, for the same money as that, in fact, less, I can have a Cupra R instead. Can I have it? And she was humming and haw for a bit, and then presumably probably looking at my sales figures, which were good at the time, and went, and her answer was, if I never hear anything about it again, yeah. So at which point, don't oversell. Hang up. You've got the buy. Don't gild the lily. Don't do what that awful poor IBM dude did on the golf course at the 18th, where he said to the guy, and you can write this off over the next 5 years. It's a great investment. And he went, I'm selling the company in 18 months. I no longer want to buy your product. 25 million quid's worth of fucking servers up the Swanee. You'd won the deal. Shut the fuck up. Yeah. Don't do that. So I just walked away. And the only time I nearly got bitten by it was two times. One was after like 7,000 miles, the Pirelli P0 Rossos that they sold it with were through to the canvas on the front, like with spikes of wire and stuff sticking out of them. And my boss said to me, like, dude, like, you need to pack in, you know, if that carries on, you're gonna get in the shit for this. And I managed to persuade him it was just because they were oversoft. And we put Goodyear Pilot Sport Eagle, something or other, was on. No, we put Goodyear Eagles on the front instead. And they lasted 15,000 or 12 and a half to 14. By that time, everyone had forgotten about the previous time anyway, so it didn't matter. Other than that, well, when I lent it to Stu to go down to Le Mans, because I told him about it in a pub whilst we were chatting, because he's a car guy as well. And he was like, well, if it's a company car, can I borrow it to go down to Le Mans? And I was like, well, you're the only one that knows, so it would look weird me lending it to you. So we had to concoct some pony and trap about how it was my car on a lease, but I was going to lend it to him anyway because I'm a solid geezer. And yeah, he rang me up, like, presumably after they'd had a couple of little toots when they arrived there, and bragging about how his mate Trigger couldn't lose him in his E34 M3. Apparently, there'd been the eye widening bit for him had been when they'd been caning it down some French hill, and he'd realised that there was the line of traffic ahead where they were going to be pulling into had come to a stop. So he was still accelerating to get past the car he was overtaking, so had to keep accelerating, then pull in, and then get on the anchors. It was so close and so screechy of tyre, but stopped, that Trigger got out and wandered back to him and went, calm the fuck down, mate. And then, like, went and got back in his car again. Because he was like, it was like a cigarette paper between the nose of the Cooper and the back of his Beamer. But yeah, it was, he couldn't say enough good things about it. And it was, for a front wheel drive car with 18 inch rims, those rims were amazing. The difference between the Cupra and the Cupra R in look was just so much more gangster. Where, you know, the proper coultard chin spoiler and those alloys were amazing. Coultard
chin spoiler. Yeah, you're absolutely so, yeah. Right. The coultard chin spoiler. Yeah.
I mean, and I like David Coulthard. Like, I've got no problem with I did have at the time where he was racing, but like, he's cool. It was a cracking car. And having that freedom, it's the same emancipation you get with having any car at any point in your life. But I think that used to be more true than it is now for a lot of people.
So Le Mans story there, my hooligan behavior on the road to Le Mans. Do you remember I went with that lad, Nick Riley, who I worked with? And Nick had just finished building a replica, like James Dean, like Porsche RSK, like that ear, like, but it was a Volkswagen, it was not a Volkswagen Beetle chassis, and it had like a hot rod Beetle motor. And Nick had a mate who worked for one of those companies like Aslan, and it may have even been Aslan. And the mate was like super Fordy. His name, I remember, was Ian. And Ian had a Robin Hood, which was like a Westfield, like a Caterham replica. And it had a Pinto bored like to 2.1 with like twin Weber 45s that, you know, Ian's mate from Essex had like, so you knew this thing was like a fire breathing thing. Well, on one of those, you know, long French roads, long French downhill, he got alongside us. We'd been leading and he got alongside us. So we were like alongside each other downhill with these two things absolutely wrung out, probably 110, 120 miles an hour, that kind of speed. And there was a railway crossing at the bottom of the hill. So the tarmac wasn't completely smooth. It flattened out. It wasn't as if there was like, you had to like hump across the rails. It was smooth, but it was still like, well, over the bump. The engine mount on the Porsche Volkswagen affair broke. I don't know if it grounded or, but after that, it was clear that the engine mount was broken, and that, I think, considerably spoiled the experience for Nick. I remember when the engine mount was effed, I remember thinking, well, that has spoiled things somewhat. That year, it didn't have a roof. Neither car had a roof, yeah. And it pissed down. I remember looking at the puddle when we came to drive home. I remember looking at the puddle in the seat of the Porsche, you know, in the passenger seat where I was about to place my hitherto dry arse.
Yeah, but no, I mean, it's you know, the road trips and owning a car like that, where it's, you know, you use it for company, but you also use it for your car as your everyday drive, does lend a certain fondness to them, because you really live in them. I mean, you know, if you're doing 30, 40K a year with work, you know, you spend a lot of time in that car. And I mean, look, it also, I think if you want to get macro about it for a modicum of a second, you know, there was a noticeable difference to me in the politeness levels of business now. They're just worse. They are just flat out worse, because people are more than happily have several presentations with you over video and then just blank you, literally never speak to you again. Whereas if you'd done that where you've had a meeting face to face at any point in that, you'll at least get the Dear John conversation. You'll get a sort of, we went ahead with a different company because of X, Y, and Z, and this is why you didn't win. And that's really useful feedback for anyone in sales who wants to be better in sales, actually understanding why you lost and either being able to craft the proposition or often craft your message better in order to perhaps resonate better, because you probably didn't either speak to the right people or didn't caress the right sort of hot button topics for them. You know, because people don't always buy the best product, let's be clear. They buy a product that they like, or they buy from people like them. So that's how it works. So if you want to craft your message, the fact that people are more than happy to, with this video link and social media anonymity and all this sort of stuff feeding into the fact, they just feel it's acceptable to just down tools and never take your calls again. Literally after saying, right, we're into the last two, we'll let you know how it is. That's answer enough, apparently, is to just never talk to you again. And that's pervasive. I've seen that, not just me, like a lot of people I've spoken to in sales have found that. And that's a telling drift there. So not investing in the time to go and see people is changing that dynamic in lots of ways that customers who would then say, who the same sort of people who would complain to you about the shitness of salespeople are in ignorance contributing to the shitness of salespeople by not providing feedback on sales that they weren't happy with. So those mofos never get any better.
I realized putting together like my kind of talk track here that I had a sort of annus horribilis. Remember the Queen talking about the annus horribilis? I had an annus horribilis immediately after the millennium. Because remember, at the time of the millennium, we were at Loch Ness, and you had struggled up company carless in a Sierra, which had been blowing radiator hoses and Lord knows what else all the way. I had a brand new Vauxhall Vectra that I'd gotten like off the truck with like 14 miles on it or something. Not a great car, sadly, S202 BVT, but that was what I had that time
Yeah, I remember you said it was understeery as hell.
It was worse than my dad's Cavalier. What I couldn't credit, and what I still can't credit, is how the engineering took a step backwards from one car to another. I don't understand how you can make it worse than the it wasn't like the Vectra rode much better than the Cavalier or anything like that. It just wasn't so just hub nut for all you people who were like, why Ford? Because Vauxhall's never handles as well. And Rovers, did you want to look like your grandpa? Hubner, I know you did. I didn't want to, right? So when people are like, why Ford? Why are Ford worth more now? This is why. You were like Gammy. You were like the gear model straight away. You framed it in. We talk in Ford language. That's why Capris and Cortinas are worth more than Cavaliers and Mantas are and ever will be. And I'm just going to step off my Ford guy.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agreed. You can still get parts of them as well.
My annus horribilis, though, right? I went from MTI, who were a small player who'd given me that Vectra, and I went to EMC, who I had access to that wonderful pool. And remember, I ordered a 2000 model year Subaru Impreza Turbo, or WRX for our American listeners. And do you remember, I got them to agree to pay a bit extra so I could have the short throw shifter. It was dark blue, Subaru Rally blue, short throw shifter, and it had these like Enki look, multi-spoke, gunmetal grey. It arrived the day they fired me.
That was a hard one.
It was.
Yeah, I remember.
It was.
Although, to be fair, you didn't order aircon, if I recollect, which was a new move.
Well, now I feel better about the fact that I never have had a Subaru.
That's why I reminded you of that.
Yeah. I went for the wheels and the short throw shifter instead of the aircon. Yeah, that would have been a new.
Well, no, yeah, I think you were harping on about how it was going to add like 50 kilograms of weight. I was like, yeah, well, you're going to be sweating 50 kilograms of weight on the M1.
Well, it wasn't me sweating it out, was it? It was some other poor bastard that got the car, wasn't it?
Yeah, some other poor mofo in there, yeah.
So, yeah, so I was fired. So do you remember then I had the Sierra, the white Sierra that we shared, right?
True. Yeah.
And then I bastard threw that in a ditch like a fucking idiot, didn't I? Well, did you also?
You got the nice green Jaguar bag nicked out of the boot with all its D&D books.
Yeah. Ouch. Yeah. The loss of the D&D books, the loss of the car, the fact that I truly owed you a car, which made up for the fact that we'd used my Lincoln in America, but I still feel like I kind of owe you a car. You know, when I'm Joe Rogan sized, when our pod is Joe Rogan sized, I'll buy you a Camaro ZL1 to drive around the lanes of England or something like that.
I'll let you sweat off my
celebrity balls. But yeah, 3 speeding tickets I got in that year as well. So I nearly got banned. So that was my annus horribilis of driving in that company era. So listen, right, to move us on, because, you know, I love to keep the pace up in our
It's a tight conversation
here. What were you driving 10 years ago?
10 years ago. I mean, probably the Zed, mainly.
Now, remind us what it is.
I'll put pictures. 07 350Z GT.
Silver
with the raised alloys,
the post facelifty one, with a little bulge in the hood and the raised alloys. Z car garage poster on the wall, the launch poster of that car, your car, but in gold, raised alloys, and I really believe that is peak 350.
Yeah, I wouldn't change it for any of the ones that came before or after, to be honest, of that sort of 350, 370 or anything. I mean, I've had a 370, I smashed that one up, didn't I? But and it was fine, but it wasn't as good in so many ways. It was just less. Even down to little things that should have made you happy, like the fact that it had a button on there for like synchro matching on the downshifts. Fuck off. It's a 350. I've done like 120,000 miles in. I don't need your help. You know, I mean, I understand why it's there. But it's, I didn't want it, but it's, I mean, look, it's, so I didn't feel all that bad when I smashed that one up. I did anyway, because I smashed up any car I always feel bad about. And, it's not really happened to me before. So that one felt bad, but no, yeah, that I think, obviously I've still got the same motorbike as then as well. So I still own both the vehicles I owned then. They're both in the garage.
You know what I had at that time, and this is when I was forgotten, the stinky Subaru. I had that Impreza wagon that leaked oil everywhere, and it leaked oil from the heads onto the exhaust, so it smelt of oil all the time. I had that. That was my car 10 years ago. So we touched on this earlier. Today's music, Running Wild, right? And we actually began this episode. Obviously, we haven't, because you and I haven't listened to it, but the listeners will have heard this episode begin with the Priest song, Judas Priest song, Running Wild, which is, of course, what gave the band Running Wild their name. And we got onto Running Wild because a couple of episodes ago, we were talking about the German power metal, weren't we? And you were like, if we're doing power metal, what about Running Wild? And I was like, they're getting their own bloody episode. And I want to say, right, we didn't talk about what this power metal thing is, but really, it's like Iron Maiden never changed from like 1984, isn't it? It's like this the German bands, they listened to what Iron Maiden had done in the early 1980s, the lyrical content, the way the music was composed, or everything about it, and they just sort of fossilized that and mined this one silo. There's whole bands that are themed around Lord of the Rings.
Dude, there's loads of that stuff. The Scandinavia region likes that shit a lot as well. So you've got your dragon forces and all that sort of stuff who've sort of remained sort of...
True to that. So Running Wild, pirate-themed songs, cheesy lyrics, monster riffs is how I wanted to frame that. Yeah.
Definitely.
20 years ago, what were you driving?
04. Probably one of the Cupras, I suspect. I think that's what I had. Well, that's what I had before I got the Z, and I got the Z in 09. It probably would have been the second, the 225 horsepower Cupra R. The first one, I think, was 210. Notable changes being it had the little like central line in the steering wheel for the sort of rally flavor feel. A slightly better stereo. And I managed to get thrown in on the weird deal that I got through my bank to buy it, that they would put this cool little sat-nav thing, which had a titchy little screen in it. And it had this weird subscription service where you just rang up every now and again and paid like 50 quid. And they'd give you X number of drives on that. But it was the best one I've ever been on for up-to-the-minute updates. 4 or 5 times in the course of 6 months, it told me to get off the motorway with a sort of flashing, urgent, get off the motorway. And as I got off the motorway, you could see the queue beginning at just down the way. An amazing sort of... That was the one that took us on that cross-country route to Alton Towers, where Dens had his company car and I led in mine. You remember that day where the three of us drove up there?
I do remember that, yeah.
And it took us straight in and then to the side exit, and we literally turned in from a back alley road and missed the entire queue into Alton Towers.
Yeah.
You remember those poor bastards had wrecked that Saxo VTS up against the stone wall as well?
I do remember that, yeah.
That was a cracking back road, and that told you that the locals knew it was a cracking back road as well.
Yeah. You know, the other one of those, that VTS one, always puts me in mind of, do you remember that time we went to the Uffington White Horse, and we'd been out all night, like at a gig, and in the morning, as we were leaving the Uffington White Horse, there was like somebody on their way to church or something, some old lady who'd overturned in the lane. Do you remember?
Oh, vaguely, yeah.
The ambulance and everything had already been called. We weren't first on the scene, which, given our circumstances at the time, if you remember that we'd just been practicing our banger racing technique in the car park near the Uffington White Horse, hadn't we? Like hanging out the tail in your in that same old grey Sierra E773 NKV.
The Slayer. Because I'd cut up the badge, I cut up the Sierra badge, so it said Slayer on the boot instead.
Yeah.
Which remarkably good. It's easy to do with the Sierra. You only have to cut a few cuts and like nearly taking your tip of your thumb off because you weren't paying attention properly. But it was it was well worth the effort.
Yeah. Yeah. So instead of Sierra, it said Slayer, but in the Sierra script. Yeah, very cool. I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
By popular demand, the Chronicles of Halvar and Clarence will soon be released as a series of audiobooks. Join me, Halvar, the world's greatest, most brilliant, strongest, toughest, sexiest, and most modest barbarian as I crush wizards and kick ass. Oh, and yeah, Clarence might bother to show up. He's a gnome thief, the smallest member of the crew. Ha 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 ha, a real tinky winky. Ain't that right, Titch?
Very true, big man. However, I can always introduce a comely wench to a truly massive cock, now can't I?
Ha! You can! I, of course, have a... Hey, hold on! Hey, hey, fuck you! Come back here, you little bastard!
Double or Quits by J.D. Gammy. Available now on iBooks, Audible, and everywhere that's cool.
So, much beloved British soccer player Gary Lineker called me a motherfucker once. Do you remember? You weren't with me.
No, I don't. But
he looked me right in the eye and said, well, I didn't hear him say it. It was through the windshields of our cars. But do you remember when I was at EMC before I was fired from EMC when I had the pool cars? Remember, I had a Volvo S40 for a little bit. Terrible thing. Do you remember I also had that red Subaru wagon, Subaru Legacy wagon?
Yeah.
It was only a four-cylinder, but like all Subies, it loved to rev. So it was slow, but it gave what little it had very willingly, and I was happy with it. Lovely shift. Subies always have a nice, nice shift. They're probably better to drive than a lot of Hondas, I reckon. Well, anyway, my boss had invited me to our house, right, as for a, like a, you know, you're going to get fired if you don't sort it out kind of conversation, right? She lived in one of those, like, nicey villages, Ascot way. Right. And I guess Lineker lived there as well. And I guess it's one of these where there's like a tree and there was a lane and you had to go around one way or something. Anyway, I was going the wrong way. I knew I was going the wrong way. He was coming the other way and there was a screeching of brakes. And that was when he implied that I had sexual relations with my mother. Or at least I think he did. So, yeah.
No, they don't put that in the crisps advert, do they?
No. No, foul-mouthed. On the theme, we're talking about company cars here. Do you remember, just for a hot minute, when I was working for MTI before EMC, and they were those ones off the hog's back, the office was in Guildford, just where the WWF offices are now, or were there, I don't know if the WWF is still there, anyway, long and short. They gave me for a little bit before I had the blue Vectra that we just talked about having the terrible understeer. They gave me a green Vectra SRI. It was a 2 liter.
I remember.
It was still four cylinder, not a V6 one.
Yeah.
But it was green and it was a sedan and it was not quite, but it only had about 1500 miles on it. Love that car. That car made a huge impression on me. That was why when I first was, you know, shaping to come to England and was looking at buying cheap cars for like an England summer trip. That was why the first thing in my mind was a Vectra GSI, because I love that green Vectra SRI so much. In Vauxhall land, SRI was warm. GSI was like Cosworth level hot, like approaching like 170 or 190 horsepower as opposed to like 130. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I did like, do you remember my boss, that terrible recruitment company I was at? My boss, Alan, had a grey Cavalier SRI, like Mark II Cavalier SRI, with no wheel caps, J191 RBH. Sadly, it's gone. I did look it up. If there's one car I would love it, was that. It wasn't that fast, but it was so willing. It was so much better than my dad's Cavalier CD that was the same design, like 2 liter CD that was like a G play. What happened to the M2?
Oh, I'm nothing at the moment. I'm going to get rid of it. I've got its service done and a few other things. I can't trust it. It's not a trustworthy car. So I'm going to get rid of it. I'm basically waiting until I get this audiobook done, and then I'm going to be full tilt getting onto a job. And as soon as I got a job, I'll swap it out for a at the moment, the Yaris GR, I think, is what I'll go for. I don't feel the need to have like 400 or 500 horsepower at all anymore, because like even that BMW, it's not as fun. I have more fun in the 350. I have more fun in the hot hatches. I have more fun in my wife's Fiesta ST, because you actually have to pay attention, and it's, you can drive closer to the car's envelope and closer to a reasonable speed on the road. You know, I mean, I accept that it's speeding on occasion, but not in a sort of built up area and not in where there's anyone likely to be inconvenienced if I was to make an error, which I've consistently not done across my career, other than like a hedge and my ego. So I'm not taking any risks with any people. But the trouble with any of these modern cars is increasingly I don't want to become like an old, like, you know, your dad and a complete old fart. Bless your dad, at least lovely bloke. Just using him as an example of sort of, you know, sensibleness creep, if you will. you just don't need it. It's like, it's ridiculous. Like, because it just means that you have to get out of the gas faster. It just means that you have to go further away from the car's performance envelope. Yeah. It's the same reason, you know, a lot of these people that are buying these Desert X's and stuff like that in the motorbike world, more power to them, have fun, yeah? But, I mean, you're buying it for the cafe culture porn show. You're not buying it to go off-road. So about 5%, or probably less than 5% of these people will actually ever see even a fire road on those things. And good luck to them. That's absolutely fine. But therefore, you know, you're taking these things that should go on a track, not going on the track with them, and not really ever enjoying them or seeing the performance rewards for it, because, you know, you're not actually balancing the car at the performance limit.
I do think that's a super valid point, this idea that you need to, it's, you know, it is more fun driving a slow car fast than a fast car slow. If you're struggling to find some way of enjoying, and I really, you know, I do really appreciate this with the sports bikes that, you know, a Gixxer Thau will do 100 miles an hour in first gear. The bike's 20 years old. It has no ABS. It has no traction control. You know, this is a very hard thing to try and enjoy in an everyday kind of context. It's a hard thing to enjoy even on a track, right? And I do think there's a case for having the wonderful thing, but I also think there's a really strong case for being disciplined enough to, you know, having the thing that's right for you. The Fiesta, you know, I have a Fiesta ST as well. Love it to pieces. It is, yeah, the right
thing. It's amazing. I mean, you can't knock it.
What I would say, one warning I would issue to you, its first set of tires lasted 19,000 miles. They were kind of worn at about 3,000 or 5,000, but, you know, I guess the fundamental chassis is so good that the handling tailed off without me really noticing and remained so good that it just didn't bother me. But with it being water about here, I decided I would get a better tire. But then when you're in the tire rack shop, you look around, and the long and short is I've ended up with Toyo Proxxes 888Rs, which are, they're street legal, but they're designed for autocross and track work. I picked it up and they are so noisy. I was like, what's wrong? Like, have they fitted them wrong? I went round and they're the right size and they fitted right. And they look awesome. The car looks awesome. The car sits better than it did before. Not that it looked bad before, but it looks terrific now. I Google up the reviews. One review where they're talking about how noisy it is, right? There's 5 reviews. All of them are talking about how noisy it is. One guy, in response to how noisy are there, was like, noisy, like a Stuka dive bomber. And that is how it is. It's, you approach traffic lights and it's like a, like off-road, you know, like when people put big tires on SUVs, mm-hmm. like it has that kind of like rolling rubber kind of noise. So for the first, I would say 48 hours, I was like, what have you done? Like, you could have just put Pilot Sports on it. The Pilot Sports were cheaper. What have you done? And then it was dry up by the Cliff House. And oh my word, like, it is transformational. Like, I didn't think, my mind has been blown by how much better. I didn't think the Fiesta could get that much better. I didn't think a front-wheel drive car could get that much better. The really striking thing is the bite on launch. Like, the launch bite is just unbelievable. Just
the only thing I will say about them, I suspect, because anything like that, when you went from Goodyear Pilot Sports to like Pirello P0 Rossos, the Reds and stuff like that, you do get like 15-ish%, 20% more. And if you're a tuner car and you know it on the back of your hand, you'll appreciate that sort of 40-50% rather than the actual 15 or 20% it really is. But you will get probably about 40% higher tyre degradation. Now, I'll take that, don't get me wrong, but therefore, you're going to have to change them more quickly, and it would behove you to do so, because the danger with that is you start driving up to what it could do, and then the fall-off will be quite quick. So, you know, you've bought into that now. You're now addicted, yeah, like, unlucky. You know, you've had your first crack rock. You've just got to keep having the pain for the crack rocks now. Yeah. So you just have to bigger and neat more often. So unlucky.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, the noise is annoying, but Ollie said to me just the other day, like, I'm used to the noise now. And I was like, not bothering me too much. It crashes through potholes even worse than it did before. But I'm telling you, Yami, that the launch in second is just that. When it goes through that torque steer that it does at 4 or 5 grand, it does that even more. It's like you feel it.
Well, I mean, we've got a man-tuned exhaust on Andy's now, because the exhaust went, and Ford were like, yeah, no problem, we'll get you an exhaust. It'll be like 1,400 quid. And I was like, can I have a quote for it without including fitting and stuff? Because, like, I want to compare it to the aftermarket one. And the bloke went, that isn't including fitting. At which point I thanked him politely and hung up and called Mountune instead. And the guy was like, yeah, mate, we've got one in stock. It's like 575 quid for the full cat-back system. Yeah. I was like, all right, send it over. So we got it through the post, and I got a local mechanic to fit it. It is boomier. Yeah. And I checked the reviews before I bought it to see how boomy it is. And it's not unbearable. And you go through the bit where it's really boomy, about 3.5, and then you sort of come out the other side and it's like not as boomy. But it does have that sort of like start it up in the petrol station kind of this, which is quite funny. But yeah, it was an economy, but B, like, what am I going to do? Pay 3 times the price for a shit of exhaust? Like, piss off. And also, the next step is you can get the cat up and the performance cat for about 600 quid, and you can get the chip and air intake and long and cooler filter thing for another 600 quid, which then moves it from like 180 to 200 to about 225. So I said to Angie, well, if you're going to keep it, you might as well have those other bits, you know, the next time you're feeling a bit flush. So she's going to do that.
I do feel like, I mean, there is no exit strategy for me out of ours.
Well, the Mountune shit didn't even invalidate the Ford warranty when they brought it out. So as far as I'm concerned, you might as well buy it. It's like Ford. If it basically doesn't invalidate the Ford warranty, it's Ford approved. You know, it's basically tuner part Ford didn't make.
I can't believe the dealership are charging $1,400. I mean, that is...
Dude, it's like they don't want to know with old cars now. I can't... I mean, if I want cut parts for the Zed, I have to ring them up and, like, fax it in triplicate and then wait for the goddamn boat to arrive from Japan.
Yeah, that has moved into classic status, though.
Yeah, I know, but, like, this is a 2015 car. I mean, do you know what I mean? It's, like, not old. I mean, but... they don't want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I got the notice through, mine needs to be smogged. For the first time, right? 6 years old now, which
it should be fine.
Oh, I think so. It's absolutely bog standard. No, so I'd be very,
I wouldn't worry about that.
Just the fact that it's crossing the line to being old like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of Angie still wants a 4-door car because she wants to, But yeah, it's, you know, her mum and dad are getting on, and like, you know, dad, mum's 80 now, and her dad's in his late 70s, and they struggle with a coupe to get into the back seats. So, I mean, she was like, well, what
else? Get old E63, like you were going to.
Well, but this is the point. I mean, I'm really helping, of course, by having two-door cars and a one-seat bike. So, I mean, I'm not really helping the cause.
Yeah, an E63. They're lovely.
I don't want a fucking great car like that. This is my point. I mean, I don't see the need. Like, I feel profligate driving huge bits of metal around, which are less fun than I can have in a genned-up little rally car replica that I can spank around the B roads and C roads. That's why I want the Yaris GR. I can't see anything that's going to give me more smiles per mile on B and C roads than a little 280 brake horsepower four-wheel drive tricked up homologation special. You know, the fact that it's Toyota is an irony, but I'm sort of appreciating that irony.
It's not really Toyota though, is it? It's Gazoo. It's like they did the work on it.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, fair enough. I'll let them have their halo glow. Do you know what I mean? They still, Mr. Toyota, it was his passion project that, like, it's going to be something that they want to build. And I respect that. So, you know, but I did say to her, like, you know, you could get the 1.6 that came after, or the 1 point, whatever it is, the three cylinder one that came after. You can get that in a four door, or a five door rather. But I mean, it's going to have to be a pretty sexy car for that to like go, because I'd still rather have it and it just like sit in the corner of the drive and be kept. Because as I discussed before, if we end up living in France, that is what I want to keep here. So we've got a car here all the time, because it has multiple advantages. It's small, it's cost effective, it doesn't take a lot of room, and Angie knows it at the back of her hand. So both of us are pretty comfortable driving.
And not for nothing, if you do move to France, there is a business waiting to be made around cars that are outside of the 25-year thing, cars that never came here. So people here, you know, everyone knows the Group B stuff, right? So they know the 205, but they never had 205 GTIs. I've never been to a Cars and Coffee here and seen a 205 GTI. I think if you sourced a 205 GTI in France, if you sourced half a dozen of them, filled crates with them, I had them here, I could drive to Cars and Coffees and sell them, and we could.
Oh, I mean, I think the 205 might have already left the building, even here. I mean, even in France potentially. But
we know the other stuff, right? We can always look deeper and farther. And my experience, you know, that vacation that I had to France last summer, I was poking around. I mean, there's stuff at the side of the road, isn't there? Any garage at the side of the road, you just pull over and have a look in their yard, and the stuff that hangs out in the yard, I saw interesting stuff. I saw what I thought was a Safran by Turbo that turned out to be a Monaco, but you know, there's you never know what you're gonna stumble upon.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, yeah, if you know, you know. And like the 205 GTI, you could get the same engine in the 309 ugly body version of that. Well, that would have been a cracking car. I wanted that at the time. We didn't have the cash for the 309 GTI at the time, but you could get it, and it was still on the same thing.
They were cheap. I remember
GTI 6. That was an absolutely blistering car. The six gear, quite a tidy looking little motor.
The 309 GTI to the 306. To be honest, the 309
cleaner look on the 306, but still, yeah. I mean, the 206 GTI. That was the 106 GTI. Sorry, the 106 GTI was the one that was the absolute five star.
That was the same as the Saxo, wasn't it? Same car as the Saxo.
Can you get a 106 Rally as well that came on steel wheels in white?
Yes, you could. In fact, Chops had one a while ago now, but Chops had one. So they, the rallies, you could get a 306 Rally as well.
Yeah, you could, yeah. Slight segue for you. I mean, so one of the thing I added to the list earlier on today was Gandini died.
Oh, did he?
So just recently. So I was thinking about him, and of course, he designed the Renault 5 Turbo.
Oh, did he?
Small French hatchbacks. He did the original Renault 5 Mark II and the Renault 5 Turbo, as well as all the Lamborghinis that he did. He did the Cizetta V16. He did the, what else did he do? I was looking him up. He did, yeah, the Lamborghini, Harry's one, the Espada, the Miura, of course. He did loads of those, that stuff. So it's worth having a look.
Some of the shit that guy did. Rest in peace. Was it Maurizio? Was that his first name?
I think that was it more Marcello?
But Gandini, we
Marcello Gandini, yeah.
Yeah, the like.
The one I asked my wife to have a quick look at, like, what a classic and sports car recommended as his top 20. Her choice was the concept car that was the Espada was based on, which was the one-off Bertone Pirana. The Bertone Pirana, a one-off commissioned by the Daily Telegraph and based on Jaguar E-Type running gear.
Huh, interesting.
There you go.
On the loo with nothing better to do? Surf on over to Summers & Son Used Car Trading, conveniently available on eBay. Pick up one of our carefully curated and freshly prepared Hot Wheels, Matchbox, or Corgi diecast models. Or indeed full-size real cars. Because why not? Featured lots include a 1968 Lesney Volkswagen camper van, a terrific model only missing one single door, a mere $5 plus shipping. Also on offer is a 1977 Lincoln Town Car. This one is a real car. It is 25 feet long. You can sit in it, and it even runs and drives, replete with the patina that you would expect. Nay demand from Summers and Son. It's a snip at $1,000. We look forward to your bids. Thank you for listening. Now we will return to our regular scheduled podcast.
I have a few interesting thoughts to take us home here. Car consignment, where, you know, you give your car to a dealer and he sells it for you and then he gives you the money. Number of court cases recently where, you know, people have absconded with money where cars have been sold and money's not been exchanged. And, you know, I'm struck by what the VinWiki guy, Ed Bolian, always says, which is that at no point should the ownership document, the car, and the money all be with the same person. However you work a deal out, you need to remember that at some point, you know, one person can't be holding all three, because if that happens, there's the chance of dishonesty. If you stop that from happening, there can be no chance of dishonesty. And I just think that's an interesting way of figuring out trading. Yeah, the Lincoln supposedly sold. Some fellow in Mexico, he's paid me the deposit. A truck is coming. I await the details. This is
cool.
Action, Mark. Who knows when it's going to come?
Well, mate, like, good luck. I mean, get some space back.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, the racing car needs to fit in that space because Scarlett wants it out of Jason's place. But, you know.
All right, Jason gets some space back.
Yeah, well, Alessandra gets a drum kit. That's
That's a good reason.
That V10 Porsche, the Carrera GT, I just want to underline the rise and rise of that car. I know you love it. I know we talked about it when we were our Goodwood episode. We talk about what the sort of great crossover car that is. And we talked as well about how my Pebble Porsche friend Wayne loves that V10 Porsche Carrera there. And I guess my thought was that in period, it was talked about in the same breath as the Enzo, the Ferrari Enzo, and the McLaren SLR. And at the time, when you looked at them, there was the Ferrari with this Formula One kind of styling. There was the...
Ugly.
Yeah, there was the Mercedes.
Striking, but ugly, yeah.
Striking, but ugly. You weren't quite sure whether you liked it or not.
Right? Yeah, I'm still not quite sure. And that's like donkey's years on. I mean, it is bold, and it is sort of iconic because it's what it is, but I still haven't grown to love it, and I wouldn't want one.
My design students, I side my class with Stanford again, and my co-tutor uses an image of it to discuss it. And it's quite interesting because people are like, well, it's a Ferrari, so I feel like I should say positive things. Yet there's a lot of negative things to say about it. Now, design guys will pull it apart from a kind of aesthetics perspective, especially the picture Barbara's got, because the picture Barbara's got of it, it looks particularly awkward in the picture. But here's my point, right? At the time, that car stole the show, right? With its avant-gardeness, whether you liked it or not, you weren't quite sure. The Mercedes, it had a normal 5-speed automatic transmission, the same as in my E55, right? So that didn't seem that exciting. And the Porsche, that was nothing but a normal Porsche, but with two extra cylinders, right? Sure, it had no roof. It was just...
Well, you can plug it in and out, can't you? But yeah.
But you see what I mean? It didn't. So at the time, the hype was all around the Enzo. With hindsight, the Enzo isn't that good looking. The SLR, of any hypercar, they have the highest mileage. Jay Leno put 50,000 miles on his.
Oh, yeah, it's that was usable. Its thing. That was its thing.
Yeah, that is the awesome. And so with hindsight, 20 years on, the Enzo, meh. The McLaren, usable. The Porsche, oh, now that is truly pinnacle analog. For some
people. No, absolutely. I mean, 6-speed gearbox, Beechwood gear stick, like the 917s, lovely little touches all around, frankly. I mean, the only other things to say, I suppose, is, well, a couple of other things to say. The Mercedes did a 722 version of the SLR that was tribute to Moss, that you could get, and it had 722 horsepower in that SLR. So, like, yeah, I mean, so... It was heavy, surprise, surprise, but to say it was mechanically robust is an understatement.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, isn't it? And just to briefly go back to Gandini to show the breadth of that geezer, why I was vaguely interested in him after I looked at him. I mean, the guy did the Citroen BX, but he also did the 365 GTB Ferrari. Well, you want a car that's pretty and minimalist. I mean, there you are. I mean, that and the Daytona shape is gorgeous. For me, it never really quite wowed me because it sort of doesn't wow you, does it? It's like sleek and like sort of less is more. And I think the Porsche sort of falls more into that category. It looks, you know, people who say it looks like a sort of elongated 911. I mean, it doesn't. You're missing the point. But it really looks fabulous. The sort of curve of the rear arches over the wheel that sort of scoots down towards the front that you sort of notice afterwards is really nice design. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a naturally aspirated V10 on a stick shift from where they were really, really sweating the details. I mean, it's like 1,300 kilograms or something. It's fuck all.
Well, thank you for that eulogy, Mark. On this same theme, right, of perspective changing, when we learned to ride motorcycles, sports bikes were motorcycles, right? Now, adventure bikes or cafe stuff are motorcycles. I hadn't realized that whole ethos was going to change. I hadn't realized that sports bikes were a flash in the pan, just like I hadn't realized that rock and roll was sort of going to end.
It's a weird place, motorbikes, at the moment, isn't it? Because there's the whole desert-y sort of like cafe racer-y sort of like there's a bunch of niches that are prominent that were niche and now mainstream. So the sort of GS style off-roader do everything bike, you know, it's now pretty damn quick as well. You know, they used to be a bit slow, but not anymore. I mean, so those things are massive.
That's why John Garcia, episode whatever he was, 3 or 7 or something like that. That's why John Garcia, the Irish guys he rides with, they all ride GSs because those bikes will do $120 all day long and they've got heated grips and your bum doesn't hurt at the end of the day. All of those guys have their R1s still. They just ride the GS.
Yeah. I mean, and so there's that niche and then there's the naked niche. So stuff like the BMW M1000R, not the double R. So it's the same engine, but with wide bars and no screen protection and that sort of thing. that's huge. And obviously the KTM 1390 Super Ducar falls into that same sort of category. You know, wheelie machines and great fun around the track still. And you, if you're good, you can embarrass superbike riders and stuff, no question. But, I mean, my always thought was when I rode naked, it was like, fucking hell, it's so tiring. You know, it's you even a modicum of wind protection, you're grateful for as soon as you're past about 70, 80 miles an hour.
It because, like, it's knackering. Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like 60 miles an hour is it. And I feel like riding a naked bike is a great way to enjoy motorcycling at a lower speed. You know, it means that the...
We're not on the M1000R. I mean, that fucking thing's got 210 horsepower. I mean, good God. But and it being a BMW, it's got heated grips. Yeah. But that was sort of what BMW offered when they arrived with the original S1000RR, wasn't it? It was like, well, we'll add shift cam technology to all you plebiscite fucking old timers that haven't got your engine tech proper. So we'll move the game on by about 20 horsepower and give you like heated grips and everyday comfort and everything.
John always says to me that if I rode, he's worried if I ever ride an S1000RR, I won't want all the jigsaws, because that's how modern, it's just everything's like, right, you can just like get on it and ride it, yet it has this sort of stupefying 180 mile an hour performance, you know, rather.
I'm showing my age, but like the 09 CBR 600 RR I've got is sort of, I don't really need much more than that. It's like, I'm going to ride it increasingly on tracks as I get older. That's my next aim with it, to have fun with it on tracks. I mean, it's better than me and will continue to be better than me for quite a long time.
The boys had Gran Turismo now since Christmas time. We're into April.
Has he got good yet?
It's been he's better than me, of course.
Yeah, that doesn't answer the question.
what I'm struck by is how this really is an introduction to the world of driving.
Is he still on the double analog sticks at the moment? Yeah.
They're haptic.
I mean, he should be. That's the correct entry.
They're haptic, right? So you've got like accelerate and brake, and then you steer like a real steering wheel.
Oh, he's doing it that way. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing it that way. It's really, I find it really natural. I find it far more natural than the sticks. So I just wanted to really highlight how I feel like I hadn't realized how Gran Turismo has retained this wonderful, very Japanese character. Yet it is this also, it's this fully immersive world of driving. It's really driving and motoring and the whole piece. I just absolutely love.
Dude, it's awesome. Like the nipping down the second-hand dealer market to see what you can pick up.
Yeah. It's just well, obviously, that's my favorite part of the game is popping down the second-hand car dealership. And I'm spending all my credits there. And then, you have to hot rod what you've got. And I've got like a signature look of, I've got a signature gold wheel that I've been,
I remember persuading Matt in, it wasn't Gran Turismo. I think it was. It was one of the ones, I can't remember what it's called. Is it Need for Speed or something? It's on an island. I can't remember what the details were. But he had enough money to buy a posh Ferrari. And I persuaded him to buy the 288 GTO. And basically. I was a bit worried compared to some of the other stuff that it would be slow. And then it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was because it's so light. It was ridiculously fast anyway.
My first buy down the used car dealership was a Sierra Cosworth. They had a white Sierra Cosworth down there, so I've got that. Yeah, and you can do a lot of stuff to tweak the appearance now. So I spent a ridiculous amount of money to get it sitting just right and, you know, de-mud flapped just right and just right thighs exhaust and all of that. Yeah, really, really most enjoyable.
Matt put mud flaps on his i30N.
You know, each to their own. It's in a virtual world.
That's exactly what I said after I'd call him a gaylord.
Do you remember the Renault Laguna touring cars, the Nestle brand 37 Renault Laguna British touring cars?
Alain Menu's car.
Alain Menu's car. And you remember they used to have those gold OZ wheels?
Yep.
My Clio is in the same green and has the same gold OZ, OZ wheels on it.
That used to, what was it? Toka touring cars round Thruxton in the rain. That was a bastard. But it was the fastest car, but like it was those, the curves out the back of the circuit in the rain, where that was an unforgiving ass game. I saw, in fact, actually, we've got a slight game segue. I watched an article the other day. Sorry, I read an article the other day in PC Gamer where they were talking about games that were, that, where they got the difficulty settings wrong. And they interviewed the guy who created TIE Fighter and X-Wing, the original games that were on the PC that came out when I was at university, you and I were at university, so 92, 90 to 95 kind of time. And Jazz had one in 93 in his room, and it was the medical frigate. It was an escort mission, and everyone knows escort missions are bastards. Well, this was the one that started the bastard, because they basically made a mission that was difficult for the people who designed the game and then hadn't bothered to tweak it before they released it. And the picture in the article had a picture of the 3.5-inch floppy disk cut up with scissors that someone had then sent back to the guy who designed the game, calling him a bastard, saying that this game was too hard. I remember that particular mission. I sent the mission and I sent that email link to Jazz on Facebook, who I haven't spoken to for years, but I'm still Facebook mates with him. I was like, you remember this? It wasn't just you and me that thought, well, God damn, this mission's a bastard. It really was. You were in your A-wing and you had to be full chat towards it. Because like, if you didn't, the thing just died before you got there. So you had to, and you couldn't just be full chat because you had to take all the energy out of shields and put them into engines and just steam in. And then once you got your speed up high enough, you could take the engine power back from from the engines, put them on front shields only, because you'd arrive like, you'd arrive at the fight like you turned up on a, you know, you joust your way through the punching fight and then have to screeching turn to come back in again. Oh, man. So, yeah, no, it was, but yeah, no, dude, like games like that where they teach you, you know, the all of the stuff around the culture, and generate their own little microclimate of culture as well, as Gran Turismo has for years, are superb. You know, there's a lot to be said for them.
Quick fire. What's your favorite company car?
Favorite company car?
Mine was that green Vectra.
Probably that Laguna.
Mine was that green Vectra, and yours was the red Laguna.
Yeah, probably that red Laguna, because like we had so many good times in that red Laguna. Like handbrake turning it round the roundabout with four up in the rain.
Yeah.
Disturbing those horse riders. We'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Disturbing those horse riders. Absolutely. We'll leave it at that. And just
handbrake turning it across the farmyard every evening when we arrive back from work. Evening.
And just to clarify, the approach to the roundabout is that one should approach, and one is approaching from a 6 o'clock position and exiting in a 3 o'clock. Position. In England, one should drive to the left and then all the way around the roundabout in a clockwise direction. And what you used to do was arrive and then do a quick Scandinavian flick to get the back of the car loose, get the handbrake on, and then the car would be broadside across the roundabout with the front tires scrabbling for grip to exit in the 6 o'clock position.
Like, good chassis, fair play to it. You know, it used to eat that shit up.
It
know?
Did.
Difficult to it not did. Love a car
It
like
did
that.
Look like it had taken some punishment, though, hadn't it? I do.
Remember we came out of the bowling and one of the suspension struts had just broken?
No, I don't remember that.
We came out of 10-pin bowling in Worcester and you and I were walking back to the car and I was like, what's wrong with the car? And you were like, oh, yeah, it looks a bit weird, doesn't it? It's just hunched down in one corner and one of the suspensions, the springs, had just broken. Because the guy came out and the green flag, inevitably, like the green flag, best UK recovery, as far as I'm concerned, ever. And I don't know whether this is fair, but AA2 stick up their arse, not prepared to help you out enough. RAC can go fuck themselves after the way they treated my mum. But green flag, always prepared to bodge you and get you home, which is what you want. I'll get it fixed next week. Can you bodge it with gaffer tape for me now to get me home? Yes, I can, mate. Yeah. Don't you worry. That's what
the art of the roadside bodge. I fear they don't do that anymore. You remember that black Mondeo that I had that wasn't the company car, but it was like a hangover from a company car. Limping it from Plymouth up to Aid's place in Worcester, it had got the broken cam belt, so I was zip tying the cam belt, and they'd last about 50 miles. Then the zip ties would break, so I'd be at the side. But I was driving on the hard shoulder. I was driving in the slow lane, and then when it broke, I'd be in the hard shoulder. Well, I was under the hood one time, and one of those, you know, police motorway maintenance people came up to me, and I was like, "Look, I can fix it in under a minute." And he was like, "If I see you again, I'm getting you towed." And I was like, "What?" I was like all excited to show off my cool fix method, and he was like not interested in the fix at all. He was just interested in me not being on the road. So I think I think that's something that's changed. I think years ago they would dodge and fix.
Oh, dude, I mean, I agree, but like they're like wannabe cops. Yeah, that's the highway maintenance vehicle, the guy that you slow down for when you see him parked in the police bit because you think he's gunning you. And then you're like, you have no authority here, and put the hammer back down. Yeah, you can ignore those losers. I remember you telling me that story and thinking, that guy can go fuck himself. He just like wants to be a little busybody harassing you. I mean, look, you know, when they turn up and they're sweeping up the gravel after your accident and being nice and helping you, I've got a lot of time for them. Yeah, just to be even-handed. Yeah. But, you know, on the other hand, I mean, they can fuck off.
Car Guy Reading 101, you're not allowed to say Evo magazine. I can begin whilst you're having a think. Ferrari's My Terrible Joys.
Yeah. I generally speaking, will check in with Matt Oxley for a MotoGP download from Motorsport. I think he's excellent reading.
Matt Oxley is far too clever for the world of motorcycles.
He's a really good guy.
There's an American dude called Kevin Cameron who's similar. Cameron is all technical and he just makes your head spin with all the physics of it. Oxley is like a Formula One guy, but motorcycles, super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think he's tip top.
So on the theme of Matt Oxley, thank you very much, Mark.
No pleasure. My pleasure, man.
See you next time.
This episode has been brought to you by Grand Touring Motorsports as part of our Motoring Podcast Network. For more episodes like this, tune in each week for more exciting and educational content from organizations like the Exotic Car Marketplace, the Motoring Historian, Brake Fix, and many others. If you'd like to support Grand Touring Motorsports and the Motoring Podcast Network, sign up for one of our many sponsorship tiers at www.patreon.com/GT Motorsports. Please note that the content, opinions, and materials presented and expressed in this episode are those of its creator, and this episode has been published with their consent. If you have any inquiries about this program, please contact the creators of this episode via email or social media, as mentioned in the episode.